Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
And Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
Welcome to the Interdependence Podcast, where we have conversations with people at the forefront of 21st century culture from our studio in sunny Berlin. You're listening to the free version of this podcast. If you would like to hear the full version and support this series, please visit patreon.com/interdependence. This podcast is ad-free and only possible through patron support. This week, we welcome Jesse Walden, who recently announced the launch of Variant Fund, which looks to support what he describes as the ownership economy. We discuss Jesse's background as an artist manager, his early experiments with putting tools into artists' hands to control the destiny of their work online, the opportunities that decentralized networks offer to help us transition away from the centralized platform economy in music and culture more broadly, and how distributing ownership to users and artists can help us transition from atomized and individualist support systems like Patreon towards more ambitious collective interdependent models online and in real space. This is an area of particular interest to Matt, so he and Jesse get really deep into some of these ideas. So if some of the technical speak is unfamiliar, stick with us as we spend a lot of the conversation cycling back to hopefully demystify it. We hope you enjoy and have a great week. Bring, 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 bring. Hi, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse.
Hey, guys.
How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for calling me.
And you're calling from Brooklyn, New York, as far as I understand.
Actually, I'm in Canada at the moment. Normally based in Brooklyn.
Oh, hey.
But I am a permanent resident of Canada. And my wife is from here. I lived in Montreal for 8 years. And that's
wow.
How I was able to get my permanent residency. And so I'm taking advantage of it. By spending some time up here this summer.
That
makes a lot of sense.
That makes a lot of sense. That's a great fallback plan. Cool. Okay, so for those who might not be super familiar with you, would you mind introducing yourself in your own words so we don't botch it?
Sure. I'm Jesse. I'm the founder and managing partner at Variant, which is a early stage venture capital fund focused on crypto networks and platforms in the ownership economy, which we're going to talk about today. I have a pretty zigzag background, which I'm happy to talk about as well, but it ranges from working in music to working in tech as a startup founder to working in venture capital at an established firm to now starting my own.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's funny. Maybe we can go into that background a little bit because I think it's a really cool opportunity in a sense. You have such a peculiar, if you don't mind me saying so, a range of or spread of interests and experience. And it's really refreshing, actually. It's really nice to be able to talk to someone who knows a bit about both worlds. But if I remember correctly, I first came to know about you through Imogen Strauss, who you founded Cool Managers with. And Cool Managers have worked with what? Solange, Dev Hynes, numerous other people. And weirdly, this must have been around 2016, 2015, something like that. And weirdly, your name initially came up because we were both at the time working on complementary projects related to artist ownership of media using what might be loosely described as like decentralized attribution networks. And this was around about the time of like the original Ethereum white paper. Would you mind talking a little bit about that project with Media Chain Labs, how you envisaged it impacting music, and then maybe also throwing in like, how did Cool Managers come about? I mean, it's a really cool little cluster of stuff that was happening around about that time.
Right, yeah. So I guess just to set the timeline, Cool Managers was started in end of 2012, early 2013 or thereabouts. It was an artist management firm. It was sort of focused on helping independent artists use technology platforms to reach their fans directly. And in so doing, trying to allow those artists to control as much of their business directly as they could. And MediaChain Labs was started in 2015, so a number of years, a couple of years after that. And it was a project that had the goal of building what we call the Universal Media Library. So much mm-hmm. like, you know, Bitcoin is an open protocol, open network that's very good at tracking a digital asset. In its case, a financial asset, we wanted to build a network that was equally good at tracking a different type of digital asset, namely digital media assets like images, videos, and songs. And the hope mm-hmm. was that if you could do that, you could allow the creators of that media to capture more of the value that they create on platforms that distribute their work. That idea was very much inspired by the work I'd been doing as an artist manager prior, and also by a, sort of a much longer history that I personally had with piracy growing up as a teenager mm-hmm. in the early 2000s. And it's kind of worth, I think, touching on that story a bit, because it is from there I can draw a straight line through all the zigzags in my career.
Sounds good.
Yeah, that's great.
So all I think all roads lead back to piracy for a lot of for like this generation of people involved with music. In my mm-hmm. case, you know, I was about like 13 or so around the time that BitTorrent was invented. And is that right? Mm-hmm.
Doesn't
matter. BitTorrent was invented in 2003.
Sometime around then.
I was in my teens anyway. And BitTorrent sort of was this like important inflection point where suddenly everyone on the internet had access to stream movies and music, instantly as if the files were already on their hard drive. And immediately prior to BitTorrent's invention, I was participating in a much smaller community of pirates that were uploading files to FTP servers that you needed to have access to, whitelisted access to, in order to be able to download all the contents. And you can only have access if you were participating in some, useful way. And in my case, it was, you know, moving DVDs that had been ripped from one server to another to earn credits for our group. But on these servers, you had access to every video game, every movie, every album, piece of software. Mm-hmm. It was incredible because at the time, you know, Netflix was mailing DVDs in the mail. There's no streaming. And I had the Jay-Z album before all my friends and could like burn them copies mm-hmm. and sell them for $5 and pay for my DSL modem. It was a very exciting sort of community to be a part of for multiple reasons.
Did you like go to school and open your jacket pocket and you had like a whole selection of different CDs arranged in your jacket?
I never went like overboard with, you know, like with selling the stuff. Like for me, it was never about making money. It was really just about like having access to all this stuff and like being able to be a fan on the like, you know, very small allowance that I had. Anyway, the reason I tell this story is that, it was sort of interesting being part of this very sort of tight-knit community of people participating in piracy at that time, and then seeing access sort of blown wide open with BitTorrent. And then after BitTorrent, you probably remember there was like Mega Upload and Rapid Share and sort of all the files just mm-hmm. moved up to the browser. And that, again, just sort of even further democratized access and came with like all these great music blogs, because anyone could suddenly distribute stuff online. But there was an obvious problem with all of this, which was that there was no good means for the community members to sort of hang out and communicate with one another in each of these venues for file distribution, from, you know, whether it was FTP, BitTorrent, or these file lockers. And around that same time, now 2008 or so, you started to see the rise of social media, which bundled together an identity and a means to communicate with, you know, with other people on those platforms, together with the means to distribute files like photos and songs and videos and so on. And that was obviously a great idea. And it was sort of the foundation for what we set up at Cool Managers, which was to help artists reach their fans using those new platforms. But it was sort of through that work that I became sort of intimately familiar with the new ways in which platforms started to control the way creators and their fans interact and how monetization works. And at the same time, I learned about Bitcoin. And what I saw in it was a protocol innovation that was in many ways similar to BitTorrent in that it's a peer-to-peer network. But it had something that all those other protocols that were used for piracy lacked, and that is that it has identity baked into the protocol. And that's the public-private key cryptography that allows for, you know, your Bitcoin to be attributed to you and for everyone to know that when you send that Bitcoin elsewhere, it belongs to someone else. So that identity system sort of being baked into the protocol was you know, an aha moment for me, because I thought, what if you could take a system like that and, again, apply it to a different type of digital asset instead of a financial one? What about a media asset? And that's what sort of birthed the spark for Media Chain that I mentioned earlier, which was to help creators capture more of the value for the work that they put online. So
that makes a lot of sense too, because right, and in a sense, also with Bitcoin and these kind of decentralized protocols, there's this kind of theme of resiliency, right? Like if you, for those who might not be familiar, right, like if you put your tracks on SoundCloud, if SoundCloud goes down, and this happened with MySpace, right? Like MySpace had all these files on there, and then MySpace goes under, and all those files disappear with it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like the so the Bitcoin network is redundantly sort of backed up across, you know, thousands of machines all over the world. And yeah, the idea with Media Chain was to build a similarly sort of decentralized and resilient network that would allow for any image, video, or song to sort of be traced back to its original creator, where you could find, you know, who made it, what it was about. We effectively wanted to give each media asset a sort of Z access that you could sort of browse through the history of that asset, you know, through its life online, and do so independent of any one particular platform. So even if the platform of that you're viewing or consuming that media on goes down, that history is still preserved.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder at the time, I mean, were you at all interacting with the work of Ted Nelson? This is something, so I mean, just to qualify this a little bit, I mean, I actually was coming at a similar problem from a very, very different background, but in the same way, like noticing that it would be really, really nice for artists to have some control over their work online. Part of the project I was working on called Saga at the time was the core idea was that, you know, music is worth different things in different spaces, right? So you would have all kind of problems where a musician would upload a track to SoundCloud or something, and the Mercedes-Benz blog could post that for free, just as the kid on Tumblr could post that for free. Whereas in actuality, it would be really nice for artists to be able to say, hey, like, it's totally fine for someone to post my work for free on Tumblr, but if Adidas is making money from this, I'd like a say in that, right? Like, I'd like to be able to express myself through that instance of the media in that particular case. Mm-hmm. And from that, I got a lot of, I mean, people were actually referring me to Ethereum and the Ethereum white paper, but a lot of that thinking came from Ted Nelson, who obviously with the Xanadu, his debates about the original protocol of the web, like pretty much foresaw the web infrastructure as being more like one, you know, global library system in which every creator and every piece of content would lead back to its creator. I wonder, were you interacting with that at all? Because I find that history fascinating. It's this beautiful kind of like counterfactual of how the internet might have been that maybe BitTorrent and these new decentralized protocols are kind of, you know, helping to realize.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say I'm definitely familiar with Ted Nelson's work and found it inspiring, but was also sort of like equally inspired by the more like practical considerations of just like trying to help the artist I was working with monetize more effectively. And both, I think, both together were catalysts for me to go down the path of starting Media Chain. But yeah, Ted Nelson is well known for the idea of hypertext, which is the idea that, mm-hmm. That I think belies hyperlinks, right? So the ability to link any text displayed on one computer with text on another computer. And his original idea imagined these hyperlinks to be bidirectional. So whenever a link mm-hmm. Was outbound, the outbound link would or the thing that was linked to would be aware of the thing connecting to it. And in practice, mm-hmm. that's not how it turned out. So hyperlinks are one direct, a single direction. You go forward, but the next dot in the line is not necessarily aware of the prior. And that's why attribution is such a big problem online, because it's very easy to break the chain of how things are connected. I think the goal of MediaChain was to sort of realize hypertext in its original form as sort of a bidirectional medium where you could connect any idea to any other idea in a sort of canonical way that preserved the relationships between the two.
And so I forget what year it was, but MediaChain, eventually you guys were acquired by Spotify and you spent a couple of years, correct me if I'm wrong, working on R&D there specifically related to blockchain applications. Do you believe that you were just kind of too early to the conversation to see some of these ideas being developed further? Or while you were there and in the process of working on that project, did you recognize any fundamental flaws in this kind of logic of artist-owned media that are worth sharing?
Yeah, right. So Spotify acquired MediaChain Labs in early 2017. The team joined and I went on to lead blockchain R&D there. And what I would say is that, with MediaChain, we always intended it to be consumed by developers. It was a developer platform on top of which mm-hmm. we imagined mm-hmm. anyone could build the next Spotify or the next Instagram on top of this open universal library of media that was programmable and could reward the creators directly for their work. I think the issue at that time, 2014 to early 2017, was that there were sort of two dominant narratives in the blockchain space. One of them was that Bitcoin would be the blockchain to rule them all. And, everything built in this space would be built on top of Bitcoin because, it was the blockchain that had network effects or had the most users. And then the other narrative was that the interesting thing about this technology was not Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, but rather the blockchain itself. And that narrative was much more focused on sort of enterprise adoption or, Fortune 500s using this technology to improve their internal efficiencies. And at MediaChain, we really didn't believe either of these things, either of these narratives. We were not building on top of Bitcoin because it didn't work for the use case we had in mind. And it was not for big companies. It was for independent developers. And what we hoped is it would catalyze sort of a new wave of innovation around how we consume and create media. So the issue was that at that time, there just weren't a lot of developers building with this technology. And we were trying to pull more people in. But one of those two narratives that I mentioned sort of won out, and that was the sort of enterprise blockchain narrative, which I think is what Spotify was interested in. They, they have a mm-hmm. problem at Spotify, which is not knowing whom to pay royalties to for songs on their platform. And it's really no fault of their own. It's to do with the fact that the people that have that data don't want to give it up to a central party where it would be easily accessible, because then they would lose sort of bargaining power with the parties that license it from them. And so Spotify sort of, I think, rightly believed that the correct solution to that problem would be to build a decentralized network for attribution data related to royalty payments for songs on the platform. And that's what they had sort of acquired us to do.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the people who have that information that didn't want to make it readily available, are those Collection societies, or are those the rights holders themselves?
It's a mix of both. So I think the biggest problem is with the collection societies, which are generally, you know, nationalized. So there's, you know, a collection society in the US, there's a different one in Canada. They have different databases. So if a Canadian and American write a song together, there's two different entries in two different databases, and often they're not synced up, and then Spotify is confused and nobody gets paid. So that's one part of the problem. But music rights are a sort of mess of, you know, regulation, and so there's like mechanical rights, and there you need to talk to the publishers directly, or I can't even remember all the details now.
It's a total hornet's nest.
So it's like it's a combination of like the collection agencies, the publishers themselves. And then there's the recording side, and having all this data sort of sync up in a clean way is basically impossible. And the U.S. government actually, I think in Congress mandated that the industry come up with a solution to the problem, because it was such a like hideous mess. And the industry just couldn't coordinate among themselves to find a solution. It had to go to regulatory, affairs to get something done. And I think that's probably a good prelude to what happened at Spotify, which is that, once I got to Spotify and started working on this problem, I realized, in the music industry in particular, the problem really isn't a technology problem. It's more of a coordination problem among all the participants. And that really comes down to economic incentives, which again is sort of the core innovation of crypto networks like Bitcoin and Ethereum and so on. So the enterprise blockchain story of, using this technology without cryptocurrency sort of falls flat on its face. In that, without economic incentives, you can't get all the parties that you need to coordinate with one another, like crypto networks have successfully done. Now I guess fortunately for me, the week that I started at Spotify was the week that Ethereum went up in price, something like, I don't even remember, but like 100x or something in one week. It went from like $8, sorry, it was 10x, from $8 to $80. And so with that, there was suddenly a ton of interest, I think everywhere, but including Spotify, in what was going on public crypto networks like Ethereum. Mm-hmm. And with that, I was able to sort of carve out some small space for my team to continue researching public networks for developers, like the one we'd been building at MediaChain Labs. This was all, again, early 2017. Spotify was set to go public not too long after that. So it became kind of clear that the company had other priorities. Meanwhile, the crypto space was really taking off. Suddenly there was all this market interest. There was all these developers getting involved. And I felt like, we were just a bit too early, and I wanted to get back to the front lines of it. So that's what I did. Fortunately, I got a call from one of our investors at MediaChain Labs, who is Chris Dixon, who's a general partner at Andreessen Horowitz. He essentially asked me what I was still doing at Spotify, given all the momentum in the space, and suggested I start a crypto fund to invest more in the space, because they wanted to do more of that. Which I declined, because I never really had invested other people's money and didn't feel comfortable doing that. So that's how I ended up at Andreessen Horowitz, because his next suggestion was, okay, if you don't feel comfortable investing, why don't you, join the firm here, and you can teach us more about crypto networks, and we can teach you more about the investing side. So that's what I did.
And what year was that again?
2017.
So you really dodged a bullet there, actually taking over, because there was a huge crash right after that.
Well, yeah. So, right. Yeah. I'm really glad I didn't
invest in other people's money in crypto projects.
Right. Exactly. Well, it was sort of, to anyone who was sort of around the crypto space at that time, it's sort of obvious that the market prices were way ahead of the fundamental state of affairs in crypto. So I thought it was inevitable the market would come crashing down. Did not think it was a good idea to start, investing at that time. So yeah, fortunately I was able to land at Andreessen Horowitz, and there was a dedicated crypto fund spun out in June of 2018. So I joined January 2018. I was only at Spotify for 9 months. But I wanted, you know, I wanted to get back to the space, and joining Andreessen was a great opportunity to do that.
Can I ask one quick question? Was anything ever built on Media? Is it called Media Chain?
Yep.
Were any projects ever built on top of it?
Yeah. I'd say the most notable thing that happened on top of Media Chain was that the network ingested a corpus of what I want to say is close to all of the images licensed under Creative Commons.
Wow, yeah. Oh, cool.
So, you know, Creative Commons is this open licensing project that essentially allows for reuse of creative work online. And so given that it's an open license, we didn't have to ask anyone's permission to ingest all this content to MediaChain. And so we built, you know, these essentially scrapers that people ran to ingest the content and deduplicate it. So multiple instances of the same image across the web were sort of, you know, compiled down to a single record in MediaChain. Mm-hmm. And the result was that you had this really nice library of free to use images that were attributed to their creators. And with that, we were sort of in talks with a number of major platforms to integrate that for image search, because they wanted, you know, they wanted to provide their users with easy access to free images that were attributed to creators, because everyone feels better when they can easily add attribution.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember at the time Kodak or someone like that pursuing, it was either Kodak or one of the big kind of image libraries came out with some pilot project that was talking about doing exactly that, right? It was like,
yeah, except theirs was called Kodak Coin, I think. And so
it was, oh, really?
it was the same idea, but as far as I know, the only thing that ever was built was the token, and it was a fundraising instrument.
Oh.
And it was by some,
oh, no.
It was by some third party group that just licensed the Kodak name. So it was, yeah, similar in spirit, but in practice, I think that they didn't actually build the thing.
Well, it's a great shame. I wanted to say, I mean, for those who maybe don't have a lot of context here, I think 2017, I mean, from our side, it's a really strange year, because I remember around about that time, obviously, like, having some interest in the crypto space, and then all of a sudden, like, the temperature going up super high. Simultaneously, it was like, it kind of accelerated things a little bit too fast. But at the same time, all of a sudden it seemed like there was this great potential to change things really quickly. And so, for example, I mean, just to validate your intuition on solving this kind of music licensing, music rights database, a problem in the way that you've described, connecting it back to this kind of legacy of pirate networks. So at the time I worked on a project with Trent McGonaghy of Ocean Protocol, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and this guy George Howard at Berkeley, Berkeley College of Music. And part of the idea there was to say, okay, like, can we produce a decentralized music database with a token-based incentive model? We were working with Simon Delarubier. Who, again, I'm sure you're familiar with, who, I don't know if Simon actually came up with the TCR token curated registry concept, or if he was just really instrumental in kind of building it out. But for those who are unfamiliar, it was basically this idea of saying, actually, the Watts CDs of the world, or the Discogs of the world, or the Wikipedias of the world, probably being the best example, right? Where you have a huge contributor base of people who basically keep the books clean, right? What would happen if you would introduce token-based incentives into those environments to help clean up these books and figure out, you know, a way to make sure that this person's money gets to the actual person who made the song, right?
Right.
And so just to validate your approach on that, I mean, it's funny to think that was, yeah, a conversation happening in 2016, 2017, but it's still kind of makes a lot of sense. But the great shame in our particular case at that time was that, you know, the year of 2017 was also the time where people were like, oh yeah, whatever, like, here's a bunch of tokens you can have to pay developers or whatever to help develop this network. And within a period of, you know, 6 months, I mean, even less than that, maybe, I forget, those tokens went from being worth enough to have runway for 2 or 3 years to literally being not worth enough to buy lunch. you know, and so it felt like this. It's funny when you talk to like most music people weren't really familiar with this stuff happening at the time, and I definitely felt like a lunatic trying to convince people, being like, "Look, hey, there's real opportunity and there's actual funds out there to build some quite radical stuff right now." And then within a period of 6 months, all those opportunities, the ideas didn't dry up because the ideas are still really interesting and worth pursuing, but those funds dried up, and all of a sudden the stuff didn't really feel all that feasible anymore.
Right.
But I just want to validate your experience, because I think it's also valid for what we'll go on to talk about with the ownership economy, to say things like token incentives integrated into these kind of organic communities like a Discogs or a WhatCD are really compelling ideas that are worth reviving.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can definitely talk about it more with regard to the ownership economy, but just to sort of tie a bow on this string of ideas, I think the period that you and I both were sort of exploring this was sort of a really formative stage, because I think back, like when I first started thinking about Media Chain in 2014, the idea that you could program economic incentives to drive participation in new networks like Bitcoin had, that idea was not widely understood. Bitcoin had done it, but Ethereum, was sort of the key unlock to making programmable economic incentives front and center in new platforms and networks. And back in 2014, Ethereum didn't exist. And so there was a sort of awkward transition where projects went from having, the right ideas about sort of decentralized user-operated networks to networks coordinated by direct economic incentives with tokens. And what happened once people started to realize, hey, that's like the exciting new thing that you can do is program these incentives, is there was this rush of interest in the market, and lots of people came in to buy up those tokens, even though the mechanisms for distributing them hadn't really been figured out. And so mm-hmm. there was this sort of like flash boom and bust cycle that I you could argue was sort of a setback to the space. But actually at Andreessen, we did this really interesting study that shows that in the crypto space, prices are actually a leading indicator for developer interest. So whenever the prices go up, mm-hmm. and this has happened in multiple cycles, like it happened first in 2011, and then again in 2014, and then again 2017, prices go up, it captures the sort of interest of developers who are like, hey, what's this new technology? What's this Bitcoin thing all about? Mm-hmm. And then many of those developers actually stick around even after the price drops. Mm-hmm. So each time there's this wave of price and speculation, there is more progress made after that. And there's probably a few more waves to go before mm-hmm. this technology reaches mainstream. But it's mm-hmm. not to say that, flood out of capital that you were describing sort of stopped all progress in the space.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Just before we move on to Variant, I do want to like clarify a little bit. Would you mind explaining just like to the layperson what a token incentive might look like? So I mentioned the example, for example, of like a Discogs or a Wikipedia, like introducing some method of local payment to that. Mm-hmm. But could you maybe give another example for someone who's really unfamiliar with it? We're running away a little.
Yeah,
sure.
Sorry about that.
No, it's cool. I was waiting for you to jump in.
No problem. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, so I think it's always helpful to start with Bitcoin, which is the sort of OG example, and then talk about how the Bitcoin model might be applied more generally. So I think if you zoom out, or widen the aperture as far as it'll go, you can look at Bitcoin as sort of a service that allows for people to store value and transfer value. And that definition of Bitcoin in many ways is similar to PayPal or Venmo or sort of any other platform that allows you to do the same thing, right? Like you can store value in Venmo or store value in PayPal and you can send it to your friends. Mm-hmm. Now, what's different about Bitcoin and networks or platforms like Venmo and PayPal is Venmo and PayPal are companies, right? And so in order to provide that service of storing and sending value, they have to hire a bunch of employees to work at the company and, build the software, maintain the software, provide customer support and market it, et cetera. And those employees are paid a salary. That salary comes from revenue that the platform is able to generate, which is generally taken from transaction fees in the network, right, or on the platform. So what's different about Bitcoin is that it's not a company. And so there is no entity that employs people with employment contracts or sort of divvies out revenue to those employees. Instead, what Bitcoin does is it describes economic incentives in open source code that anyone can run on their computer to do the work that the network needs done in order to provide that same service that PayPal and Venmo provide. So what that looks like is you have a bunch of independent computers run by people all over the world, contributing work to the Bitcoin network to provide that service of storing and sending value. And in exchange for the work that's done, the network creates new Bitcoin tokens and distributes them to those that have done the work. And so that's a sort of very crude explanation of what it means to design programmable token incentives. The incentives of the Bitcoin network are, you know, designed to solicit the work that the network needs done in order to provide a utility to its users. So you could say that Bitcoin is the first example of a network that's entirely user-owned and operated, whereas PayPal is owned by shareholders and operated by employees. And so that's a very stark contrast. And that same model that Bitcoin sort of pioneered is now being generalized and applied to other types of services beyond, storing and sending value to things as complex as, marketplaces and hopefully things like as complex as streaming platforms eventually. So yeah, I would say just another very quick way to drive the point home is imagine if a platform like Uber was bootstrapped by giving a direct ownership stake in the platform itself to the early drivers who are contributing to the network by providing their cars and their time. That incentive to contribute is a very powerful one in that, those drivers would probably be very likely to stick with Uber, and as it grew, they would also benefit economically, but by continuing to participate. So this is sort of a new model for building internet platforms that depend on the contributions of users, and it's one that I think is pretty powerful and exciting, for the next generation of internet platforms.
Can you also, just to build on that, maybe this is getting too into the weeds, but can you also explain how changes to platforms or even at the very protocol level are implemented or voted on when it's a decentralized?
Well, exactly. I was wondering because the Bitcoin example is really great. And then obviously with the Ethereum network and like the more traditional kind of like ERC-20 tokens, we don't have to go into specifics there, but the tokens there, like Ethereum also kind of brought into the world this idea that having a token was both like a store of value that could be transacted, but also, for example, something like a voting share or equity in a project, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that's right. So, I guess there's two points here. One is that when you have a network of independent operators sort of all over the world, who are coordinating to provide a service, an important question is like, what happens if you need to change the service and change the rules? And different networks take different approaches to solving that problem. In the case of Bitcoin, it's this sort of process of rough consensus where, there is no formal decision-making process. Rather, there's like multiple stakeholders, each sort of, vying to be the loudest voice in the room and get the support necessary to make a change. And generally that change is proposed in code that the other parties operating the network need to acknowledge. And they do so by downloading the new code and running it. So this idea of rough consensus is not unique to Bitcoin. It's actually a term that was coined by the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. It's an idea that's meant to be sort of slow by design, in that like when you have these protocols that coordinate the activity of lots of independent participants all over the place, you probably, in some cases, don't want change to happen very quickly. You want it to be like a, you know, a very slow and somewhat arduous process, because the stability of the underlying protocol is what gives people building on top of it confidence that the rules aren't going to change against their will. And that's been a very important mm-hmm. sort of ideal since the early days of the internet, where again, you have open protocols like IP or BitTorrent or HTTP. Mm-hmm. And if the rules were constantly changing all the time, then how could anyone integrate these protocols confidently? So Bitcoin's decision-making process is one of rough consensus. Ethereum is the same. Other networks have, elected a more formal governance process wherein participants in the network can actually vote using tokens. And so imagine like your Bitcoin tokens entitled you to have a say in how the network evolved. And there's sort of efficiencies to be gained in that you can have like a structured voting process. It doesn't have to be this very rough and sort of ad hoc consensus that's driven. You can just take a vote. And so that model, I think, is starting to be experimented with more, and is likely a better model for networks that aim to build services that are more complex than Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin is kind of mm-hmm, simple. Mm-hmm. It's just store and send value. You don't want to complicate it much beyond that. But if you want to build something as complex as Spotify or Reddit or Facebook, you know, there's a lot more mm-hmm. nuanced decision making that needs to go on a regular basis. And there you probably want some more formalized system for decision making.
So this is probably a great opportunity now to talk a little bit more about the ownership economy. So you, as you mentioned before, you moved away from Andreessen Horowitz and you're starting your own fund, Variant. We'll post links in the notes. I have to say, honestly, I think, and I'm obviously biased because I agree with you on all of these points, but I think it's one of the most positive developments I've seen in a really, really long time. I'm very excited about it. So would you mind describing in a nutshell what you mean by this ownership economy?
Yeah. So first, thank you for the kind words about it. The idea is basically that crypto networks like Bitcoin and Ethereum have sort of laid this new foundation for networks that are owned and operated by users, and that the communities that formed around Bitcoin and Ethereum were sort of first to understand and participate in this new model for community operated networks because they were technologists and developers for the most part. So they were first to understand that these digital tokens confer real economic value and thus were a good incentive to participate. But now that same idea is starting to get productized and made more accessible to a much wider audience of mainstream internet users. And so the idea behind the ownership economy is that the next generation of internet products and services are increasingly going to be owned and operated by users like Bitcoin and Ethereum are. And you're already starting to see this play out in a number of other verticals. From consumer finance to social media, and that's a future I want to invest in for a number of reasons. I think one, it's a positive social endeavor that users are able to capture more of the value that they contribute to products that they use every day. But beyond being a social endeavor, I think it's also just the strongest sort of market-driven way to build internet networks, which depend on the contributions of users. And the way I started thinking about that was sort of looking at the evolution of software over the last 20 years or so since the dawn of the internet era, where probably the most surprising success story in software history is that of open source software, which today open source software powers billions of devices, trillions of dollars of economic value. It's open source is a component in all of our phones. It's a component in most of the internet products and services we interact with every day. And open source software is contributed by a community of developers, all over the world, and it's crowdsourced. And that's the sort of remarkable thing about it. And then, as I touched on, open source software has led to some of the most valuable internet products and services in the world, which in turn also crowdsource a good portion of their products, whether that's content or, you know, or goods in the case of marketplaces or services. The very product in many of these networks is also crowdsourced from users. And so it's almost a very linear, logical extension that the next generation of platforms will move beyond crowdsourcing code, crowdsourcing content and products, to crowdsourcing actual operations of the platform itself directly from users. And the big unlock to enable this, I think, is the fact that you can reward those contributions with real economic value using tokens, which are sort of an internet native way of distributing value, very much like, you know, the way we distribute information today. So, you know, at zero cost to anyone anywhere in the world instantly. And that technology unlock, I think, is going to usher in this next wave of user-owned and operated platforms. Then that's what I'm focused on investing in at Variant.
Well, we certainly hope so. And for our own selfish purposes, we definitely see parallels between your assessment that the natural next step of evolution from the passion economy, which is the term I believe you coined in a previous blog post, the passion economy understood to be, you know, independent, let's say, artisans, craftspeople, creators, going out online and participating in patronage models, right? So deviating from traditional infrastructure to like go it alone out there with direct support from their audience.
Like Patreon, Kickstarter.
Patreon, yeah, exactly, this kind of stuff. The natural next step of evolution from there is indeed the ownership economy. And we see some kind of parallels there with our own kind of interpretation of the necessary transition from an emphasis on independence to this idea of, you know, no shit, this is what the podcast called, interdependence, right? And so for example, I mean, the one thing that I find relatively frustrating, and I don't want to call the person out, but because you might actually know the person, but I read something over the weekend. It was a piece online by a guy called Jared Dicker. Mm-hmm. The piece was called something like "The Age of the Renaissance Creator," right? And in this piece, which I'll link to, it's quite interesting, but it falls very much into in my mind, like, selling something as new that is actually already the case, which is kind of fetishizing this idea of like the indie record label and the indie startup, or this individuated, atomized individual going it alone. And like, I think in the piece he references the idea of, you know, like an artist is their own company now, you know, they take on the administrative costs, very much this kind of like passion economy, independence fetish. And it's funny to me reading that piece, because in there, and this has been a lot of our thesis in other areas, he borrows really from the storied history of independent music. There's this kind of like, in previous podcasts, we've talked with people and said, you know, that in the American imaginary, there's this very like solid idea of like, you know, Steve Jobs creating products in his garage, and then the garage band, you know, creating records in their garage and going it alone, this kind of independence myth. But to be honest, like, from our experience, we see this kind of fetishization of independence and like individuation as a real kind of misreading of the history of independent music, right? In the sense that when you overly fetishize the role of an independent actor as a self-contained entity, you kind of miss the point, right? Because the great kind of innovation of independent music was actually the establishment of interdependent, autonomous networks that were focused on communities of like specific communities from a certain place, or specific communities that were focused on a certain goal or purpose. And it was exactly that kind of mutual foundation that afforded the flourishing of the individual artist and all of those ideas that culture grew to fall in love with. Right. So in actuality, for a strong individual to flourish, actually these kind of interdependent networks, these kind of interdependent foundations were necessary, which is a subtle, but I think very important distinction when you start talking about the passion economy versus the ownership economy, right? Because the ownership economy in a sense, what you're saying, it requires networks of people creating that foundation such that the individual might flourish, rather than simply kind of fetishizing the idea that like anybody with a Patreon account and an Instagram account right now can go it alone.
Yeah.
Would you say that's fair, or am I being selfish for our own purposes?
No. I think that's the right sort of way to diff the passion economy from the ownership economy. And just one thing to clarify is the passion economy is a term coined by my former colleague at Andreessen Horowitz, Lee Jin, who's a close friend of mine. Right. And she came up with that term. And to your point, it sort of does describe platforms that enable independent workers to run and own their own businesses. But it does focus very much on the individual sort of going out on their own and doing that. And so Patreon, Substack, and so on, these are all good examples of passion economy platforms. And yeah, I would say that the difference between the passion economy and the ownership economy is that the ownership economy describes sort of a collective action where people are yeah. pooling resources together as a way to grow the pie for everyone. And the idea here is that, you know, many internet platforms depend on network effects for their value, right? A network effect is when the platform gets more valuable with each new user that joins it. So, you know, Facebook is not a useful platform unless you're there to talk to, right? And it gets more valuable as more people show up, probably, you know, to a limit. Once grandma shows up, then it's no longer, then there's negative network effects. But the idea of a network effect is...
Hey, some grandmas are cool.
Yeah, that's true. But the idea is that, you know, networks are fundamentally more valuable.
You're listening to the free version of this podcast. If you would like to hear the full version and support this series, please visit patreon.com/interdependence. This podcast is ad-free and only possible through patron support. Thank you.